So here on the Scene World podcast, we like to make friends. We've talked to a lot of different people. And one of our big friends is Captain Crunch, John Draper, who a long time ago, we mentioned that he was having some medical issues. And we prefaced one of our podcasts with information about that. Well, he's having similar things now again.
Exactly. And also we did our second SceneWorld interview via Skype with him. So, and he has been with me here in Mannheim 2 times, 2012 and 2015. So,
right, and we consider him a good friend of the magazine and of the podcast in general. So, if people would like to,
If people would like to help fundraising for his good cause, it's gofundme.com/medical-fund.
That's right. And we'll put a link to that in the description. They're trying to raise $15,000 to cover medical expenses and adaptive devices and stuff to let him continue to live his full life. And so they've raised about almost 9,000 of that 15,000 goal. So that's pretty solid, but everything helps, you know?
Right.
So again, there'll be a link to that in the description below. So everyone, I encourage you, any little bit helps to get him back into shape. Now on with the podcast.
It's you. Okay.
It's the Scene World podcast. I'm AJ. Jörg is in Germany.
Here. Yeah.
In a second, we're going to be talking to Andreas Wallström. He is the webmaster of C64.com. He's also writing a book. There's a Kickstarter currently up for it. So we'll be talking to him in a little bit about that. Before we do that, there's a little bit of news and stuff to hit on.
Yes, you want to start with it?
Sure. A few days ago, the team behind The 64, who we talked to a few podcasts ago,
Darren Melbourne.
Yes. They've released a list of the first titles that are going to be on the device, as well as also showing the plastic design for the C64, or rather, for the 64 Mini, which is the article I've got here, which is from flickeringmyth.com, and we'll link to this in the description below. It shows it's about 22 centimeters long, which in inches for Americans is about 8.5 inches. So it's not tiny, but it's not huge either. As for the games, they've announced Cybernoid, Iridium, Nebulous, and Paradroid, which are all Hewson games, and also Sam's Journey, which is a title that's being developed specifically for the machine. So that's,
yeah, but Sam's Journey is also going to be released on cartridge.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But
by ProtoVision.
Right, but it's also being developed for the 64. So that's cool to see some life out of that. It's been, I've seen some kind of disparaging remarks through the on the internet from people thinking that this isn't going to happen and whatnot. So it's nice to see some progress being made and some information, you know, given out to show where it's going and how it's doing right now.
Well, Darren Milburn is a guy with reputation, thanks to the DTV.
Right. I think there's been a lot of, you know, the Vega Plus, the ZX Spectrum, ZX. I'm speaking like I'm
yeah.
British. Yeah. I mean, this has been, the ZX Spectrum Vega Plus has been a freaking disaster. I mean, there's such drama and nonsense with it. And I think that people are looking at new projects through a filter of, you know, is this going to be another, you know, Vega Plus? So it's good to see when things aren't like that, because, you know, that's kind of a mess.
I mean, that is why we interview those people. We want to check with them and see if stuff is really going to happen the way they promised in the Kickstarter or Indiegogo and the crowdfunding campaigns.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, so what else? What do you got?
Well, I've got two pieces. So,
okay.
In Scene World 12, which was on August 2004, it's a while back.
Yeah.
We actually had a poll and news item about Katakis 2 being developed for new systems like PC. And we had a poll about that for the readers.
Yeah.
And then it was very silent about it. It's actually André Burger from Smash Designs, who also did Turrican 3 for the 64, and also did the Katakis-like game called Crush.
Mm-hmm.
And he announced back then that they are actually working on Katakis 2. And then it became pretty silent about it, and everybody thought, okay, this is like a project that's not going to happen. And he announced on his personal Facebook a few weeks ago, that he actually started with developing finally this Katakis 2. And of course, because of trademarks and stuff, it's going to be called Crush.
Okay.
So like the C64 title, but it's not a conversion of the game from 99. It's a totally new developed game. A bit shoot 'em up for PC. So after 13 years, this game is finally going to happen.
Cool.
Yeah. That's exactly like this English saying, good things come to those who wait.
Right.
Okay. So that is going to happen. And also Michael Tomczak, who was former marketing manager of Commodore, announced on his personal LinkedIn, and we will put a link to that, that he's actually working on a movie script for filming his famous Home Computer Wars book from 84 that he wrote when he left Commodore, and writing about the wars between Atari, Commodore, and so on back in 84. And when you have a signed copy of that, signed by him, it's actually nowadays worth between $300 and $600. And it's out of print for a long, long time. And it's really hard and expensive to get this book. And now he's working on a movie script. So they are planning to make a movie out of that book.
Cool. That should be interesting. I imagine that being kind of like Pirates of Silicon Valley, but with the C64.
Yeah.
Who will play Jack Trammell?
I don't know, but but it's very interesting. It's very interesting what's going on nowadays. Yeah.
So I went to the Vintage Computer Festival East last week, and that was interesting. That was fun to get to see that. I got to see an actual Commodore 65.
Wow.
Yeah, a real one.
Did you touch it?
You weren't supposed to, I don't think, but Maybe. Not saying anything. Maybe.
There are two versions of this answer. Facts and alternative facts.
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. There was a very, very impressive Commodore section, which I think actually sort of it dwarfed the sections of every other machine. I mean, they had Apples there, you know, they had a table full of Apple IIs, all the different kinds. They had an Apple I, they had, you know, there were a few Ataris, the 800 and the 400 and all these different vintage machines, but the one wall, which was Commodore based, which had all the Commodore stuff from the VIC-20 and the PET to all the way to the newest Amigas, that was probably the biggest exhibit there, and the one that I think most of the people kind of gravitated towards.
Wow. So you had the chance to meet Amiga Bill from Guru Meditation.
Yes,
and
did.
Bill Hurt.
Yes, yep. Yep, I met both of the guys from the Guru Meditation.
Wow, Anthony Winters too.
Yes, yeah.
Anthony Becker, sorry, yeah, Anthony
yeah.
Becker.
Yeah, in fact, it was his C-65.
Wow.
So, yeah, so, you know, got to meet them and talk to them about some Commodore stuff, and we discussed the pet phone and how they've been looking for it. And that's a good point that they brought up, is that I'm interested to know how many were sold, because they're not, you can't find them on eBay. Even the worst phone in the world, you can find someone selling it on eBay, and there's nothing for that, you know? And so I'd be curious to know how many were actually sold and how many Leos are and how many Leos there are, you know, how many of those are out in there? Because I would still love to review the Leo. I'd love to take a look at it.
Well, you can order it from Amazon.
I don't want to pay for it, but I'd like to review it. So, hey, if any of our listeners, if anyone's got a Commodore Leo and don't mind parting with it for a week, I would be more than happy to play with it, take some video, review it, and send it back to you.
Write to us, podcast@zineworld.org.
Yeah, because Commodore isn't giving us one.
I don't understand that.
I don't know
nice
either.
Review
yeah.
of the first pet
yeah,
phone
yeah.
and the wonderful interview we did with them.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I got to meet the Guru Meditation. I got to meet Bill Hurd, and it was a cool event. And Leif Blomquist, who we've talked to, we played
NetRacer.
Yeah, the NetRacer game. He was there. I was looking for him. I didn't see him, but he posted on Facebook from there like an hour before I was there, so I know he was somewhere in the building. I just didn't see him.
Maybe he did hide and seek.
Yeah, maybe he left before I got there or something.
Oh, HA, let's vanish.
Yeah, hide from that dude.
Yeah, so that screams for video.
Yeah, no, I took some video. I got some nice shots of everything with my new phone, my new camera here, so it's pretty quality video. So I'm going to be putting it up in a YouTube video pretty soon, so people can check that out. I've seen not many pictures of the whole thing. If there have been pictures, it's been of individual exhibits rather than like the whole room. But I did everything. You know, it was in the InfoAge Science Museum, which has, it's an old army base, and it's got a lot of you know, like old broadcasting stuff from the military and spy stuff and old radios and TVs. And I went through the whole thing, which was pretty cool. I mean, they got this giant train, you know, model train set in the basement. And so I did all this stuff, checked the whole thing out and took video of all of that. So I'm in the process of putting that together. That should be up probably shortly after this podcast comes out.
Right. So. Yeah, another thing is Thimbleweed Park got finally released.
Yep, that's out.
And we made a let's play with Martin Arman Ultras,
yep,
our latest team member, mm-hmm, for SceneVault. So we had a lot of fun. We will link to that as well.
Yes.
Thanks again to Ron Gilbert and his crew. And HA also got a code from for Steam, so he can play on his Mac. Oh my God.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Yeah, also newsletter, SceneWorld newsletter is working better than even before. Now you get it on every first of a month at 9 a.m. in the night. Okay. You get the news in your email inbox. So once again, subscribe to the newsletter. It's on SceneWorld.org. If you go to the upper right corner, you can click on the newsletter icon and just hit subscribe, and you get one email per month, and it's like a summary of our blog posts and the news there.
Nifty.
Never miss that. It's totally automatic. I don't have to lift a finger for that.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. All right, well, if things are automatic.
Yeah. All right, I think that's it for the news. Why don't we get to the good part of this? Andreas Wahlstrom is waiting right over there for us, so let's go talk to him.
So today we are talking to Andreas Morpheus Wahlstrom.
Hello.
Hello. Great to have you here. And so you are one of the very known old-time figures. You are mainly known for being the webmaster of C64.com, right?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I've been a part of the demo scene since 1987, so a lot of people know me more by the nickname of Morpheus, but the last couple of, 15 or 20 years, I've been the webmaster of C64.com, yes.
So you are celebrating your 30 years anniversary.
I'm not counting, but yeah, perhaps. yeah, you're right. I should put out a demo or something this year.
Well, Ron Absolutely. Gilbert celebrated with Thimbleweed Park.
Exactly.
There you go.
Right. But today we are talking to you because you are actually running a very successful already Kickstarter with your special Commodore 64 book. And maybe you should go into why it's so special, because the last 5 years there are tons of Commodore Z64 books coming out on Kickstarter and Indiegogo and so on. So why should people pledge your special Z64 Kickstarter project?
I think they should pledge because, you know, when I put this book together, when I started to write down what I wanted to have the book to include, put a few goals in there. And one would be an interview with Bob Janis. You know, for me, I've known Bob's name for very many years, but a lot of people don't know who he is. So I was a little bit surprised, actually. But let me tell you, Bob Janis, you guys probably know who he is. But to your listeners out there, Bob Janis is the guy that created the SID sound chip that's in the Commodore 64. Okay, and he's also one of two engineers on the Commodore 64. So he was responsible for the hardware stuff mainly, and also Bob Russell took care about the software stuff like the kernel and stuff like that. So what I always say when I talk to people, no Janis, no C64. So I've been fortunate enough to talk to him and getting detail about the SID chip and when he put the C64 together and stuff like when they quit Commodore, because that happened, I think, even before or just when the C64 came out in January of 1982. They quit because they didn't, you know, they had put this really great computer together, but they didn't get any bonuses or any extra. Actually, Jack Tramiel, the boss of Commodore, froze their salaries just to boost the their stock. So they were a little bit pissed off at that. And then they left Commodore because they realized that we can do really great products and get the money ourselves. So there's a lot of great stories like that. And it's also, I got an interview with Al Charpentier, who was the vice president of engineering at Commodore back in those days. And he also created the VIC-2 ship. there's a lot of different opinions people don't have the facts right, because, you know, different kind of things have been written about when the C-64 put together. So a lot of people think that the C-64 was just thrown really quickly, and that the VIC-2 chip and the SID chip was done in a hurry and stuff like that. And that is not true. So I'm talking with Al and Bob about that stuff. So for me, and I think for people that's interested in the Commodore 64, this is really, really, really special to hear what these guys have to say. And I've also managed to get an interview with Mr. Sed of Triad, who, to my knowledge, or if you ask me and a lot of other people, is the most world-famous cracker in the C64 scene. He started off in 84 cracking for himself, and then together with a couple of friends, they started Triad. And actually, the interview was done before I even thought of a book. So the story is about this interview. It took me 3 years to get a yes from him to do the interview. Yeah. And then it took 8 years to finish the interview, because he's very busy and he's got a family and stuff like that. So he had to come over to my place, and I would more or less babysitting him, giving him food, and he would answer my questions. So that's also very, very special, because he did an interview for a Swedish magazine in 2000, but I'm digging deeper, and he's more open these days, because he couldn't be as open before because of his job, and we talk about that in the interview as well. And get into the moral stuff, like why he was cracking and was he thinking about, you know, the games companies losing money and all that stuff, and what drove him to crack games in the first place.
Actually, you mentioned Bob Yenness and Triad, and there are two interesting facts about those things. Bob Yenness, the only interview I ever saw from him was an interview they did by email 1998. And his standard answer was always, "I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember. I have no idea. I just put the SID together, but I don't remember how I made it, when, why, etc." So the interview was pretty much useless.
I don't know. He likes to keep to himself. And maybe he wasn't up for doing an interview back in those days. I remember that Andreas Varga did an interview with him. Maybe that's the one you were referring to. From what I remember, Andreas Varga didn't have a direct contact with Bob. It was through one of his co-workers at Ensoniq or stuff like that. But so I don't know. He was very open, and he answered so many questions. And I'm going to send off a few more that popped up in my head. And he's very willing to answer all of them.
Okay.
If I get to produce the book that I'm working on, I'd like to go see him, you know, buy him dinner and thank him and hand over the book and have him sign my book.
Well, I mean, right now it's like 19 days to go and you are already halfway through. So.
Yes, I think it's looking really good. It's been this weekend, I think, was good. It was a little bit slow the last week, but it's, you know how it is. It goes up really steep in the beginning and in the end, and the real work is in the middle, so to speak. This is when you really have to promote it as much as you can. And like I've said, Bob Yenness, not a lot of people know about him or what he did. So I'm trying to, you know, do these updates and just tell people what he did, because, like I said, no Janus, no C64. There might have been a computer called the Commodore 64, but he wouldn't have, you know, looked or sound or played as good as if there was someone else, another engineer on it. That's for sure.
Yeah, the SID really was a defining part of it, just the sound that it had and the abilities that it had, which were even compared to later machines that the Commodore made, they had nowhere near the ability that had.
No. And if Jack wouldn't have, you know, if he would have given them a really nice bonus for putting out a really, really fantastic computer, they would probably have stayed a Commodore for a bunch of years and could have done the follow-up and maybe like a dual SID or like a stereo SID, put two SIDs in the 128 or something, just take it a step further. But, we'll never know what that will be. But, Bob followed on to... They did the sound chip in the Apple II GS and then continued to do the chips in the Ensoniq synths.
Yes, I was going to say he made a synthesizer that sounded a lot like the SID that shared a lot of the sound architecture or so.
Yeah.
I hear the experts talking to each other, so I'm totally not needed here.
No, but I can tell you a little bit more about the book.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but you asked me about what's special about the book. For me, I'm a graphic designer and photographer, so I always get disturbed when I see someone like they do a book and they take pictures from the internet. I mean, not everyone can be a photographer and take like good proper portraits. I understand that. But if you take pictures from the web and you use it in a book, that is like, I don't want to ever buy a book like that again because it just crawls in my whole body. So that's what I wanted to make sure that I have some really good pictures in this book. And I've been collecting images for a very, very long time. I've shared a few on the internet from the old coffee parties that I went to. I've been, to many X parties and other events in the UK and the Back in Time Live events where I've been playing the drums in Sid 80s and stuff like that. So I have a lot of material on my hard disks that I'd really like to get out there. And people also get to get a first glimpse to see how Rob Hubbard used to write his famous songs like Spellbound, Auf Wiedersehen Monty and stuff like that. Because they're in the book, there's going to be scans of his original notes. So I think that's very, very special and cool to look at.
Great.
And you're a drummer too?
I'm a drummer too, yeah.
Why have we never talked before? Good Lord.
I don't know. Well, let's do a separate session after this then.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you why we talk now, because of that book.
Yeah,
I received messages from people on my WhatsApp like, did you see this, seen that book? Awesome, you know? Make sure you get a hang of this guy, you know. But the problem with Kickstarter nowadays is there is not enough money in the world to support and pledge all the retro projects that you can support on Kickstarter. I would need a second or third job.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there's a lot of them now. But I try to look at it from. Of course, you can't buy everything, of course, but we're talking about newly produced stuff for a computer that came out in 82 that we all love. I think that's amazing that there's so many products out there. Mm-hmm. But of course, you can't buy them all. Like you said, you would have to get a second or a third job to be able to buy all that stuff that you want. So, but hopefully for this book, people's going to look at what I put up on Kickstarter and like the content. I want to do it differently in also that sense to put a little bit more focus on women in games. So I don't know if you saw that on the page, but I have interviews with four really lovely ladies. I've met three of them and the fourth one I've interviewed on Skype. They're on Skype. They're really, really fantastic girls. And their names are Karen Davis Downey, Donna Steiner Butler, Dawn Jones, and Ellie Noble. And they are all old artists that made graphics for games like Kung Fu Master, Batman the Caped Crusader, Hysteria, Tapper, K Carrot the Champ, Beezy Bill, etc. So I want to put a little bit more focus on them, because what I've seen in the other retro books are I mean, they pop up here and there. I know that that's, for instance, Don Jones and Karen Davis has been commenting on stuff for in Sam Dyer's book. But I want to do a little bit, put a little bit more focus on them and not have it just so male-centered. It's going to be male-centered anyway, but I want to push them a little bit more so people get to see that they have done amazing job. And like Donna, she made graphics for games that, you know, they never had credits in her games, like Tapper or Kung Fu Master or Karate Champ or Congo Bongo. No one knows. But she did the graphics for those games, and it's really, really good stuff.
Well, that's actually how Activision was born.
Yes. Back in the days. Yeah.
So thanks to them, there was the first third-party publisher. Thanks for never getting credit for the works.
Yeah.
So it all had some good outcome in the end.
Yes, for some.
Yeah. And then Atari did the same by creating Tengen and then battling Nintendo to release unlicensed NES games and work around the lockout chip and stuff. So that's not given credit. It's really we could make a separated podcast just on that topic, you know. So Atari getting screwed, and then like, oh, let's do the same with Nintendo that happened to us, you know. Yeah. Totally crazy story. But yes, I understand what you mean. I mean, if, for example, if you look at Wikipedia and you look at women that did stuff on computers, computer games, gaming and so on, you always find this little note like, this article is a stub. Please provide more info.
Yeah.
And they had huge, you know, huge impact and huge influence on the early, you know, computers and everything. I think the first Macs icons were designed by a woman, and she's barely got any.
Exactly.
There's barely anything now. There's a little bit more about her, but really, if you look, there isn't that much information on her and how it all came to be and all. And it's kind of disappointing to think that these were pioneers in this, and you know, they don't quite get the recognition that they should have.
Yeah. So that's the whole idea of doing something special with these ladies. They're really, really excellent. I hung out with them a few times in the UK. Three of them are based there, and one in Gibraltar, and Donna is in California. So hopefully, I'm going to go see her a little bit later this year.
You hang out with a lot of guys.
Yeah, I'm a groupie.
We also have a common friend, John Draper, Captain Crunch, right?
All right, cool. Yeah, I met him here in Stockholm.
Yeah,
for the first time, the only.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Yeah, last 2 years ago, right?
I think so.
Yeah. He was doing a European round trip.
Exactly.
And after he was visiting you, he was visiting me, and I was hosting him for a weekend.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's fun to meet these people. Like last. Autumn, I met up with Simon Nickel, Mev Dink, John Tweedy, and Gary Bracey, and lots of other people, Colin Porch, and stuff like that. And for me, I've always been interested in knowing how people got started, and you know their way to success, so to speak. So that's always been fun to me. I don't have to do an interview, but I like to get a few beers and talk about those days. I never ever get tired of it, and I think that because I've been doing it so long, you know, and I have a little bit of social skills, people are not afraid to say hi, hey, yes, even though we never met before, because as you know, there's a few strange characters in this scene, but for me, I'm always open to meet these kind of people, because we're sharing the same interest. The basic interest is in the Commodore 64, and that's what I love to talk about. And it's I always say that the book is my love letter to the Commodore 64. and I want to cram in as much goodies as I can. I want to tell you a little bit story about, you know, the programmer Martin Webb. Mm-hmm. He programmed OutRun, for instance, and he shares a really, really interesting, cool, but also a sad story about his relationship to his dad, because his dad was taking care of finance, you know, being in touch with US Gold and other games companies, and also doing the graphics for the games. And he was pushing Martin so much that they haven't talked to each other for 30 years. Wow. So that's going to be in the book. And I love to hear those stories. It's not like I thrive on sad stuff, but you know, it's a really interesting story. And he also tells when they put OutRun together and they took it to the US Gold, and US Gold had put out Jeff Brown had put up you know, a lot of computers and a lot of kids were there to test the game, because it had to be ready for Christmas 86, I think, or 87. And all of a sudden...
No, it was 86, by the way.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
So there was one of the girls screaming, "Bug!" And he had been slaving on getting this game together in just a few months, right? So he was ready to quit. And he shares in his story, he shares the memories of how he's got tears coming out of his eyes while he's trying to find this bug in the game. So a lot of enormous pressure was put on this guy. And I think it's interesting to hear this story, because throughout the years there's been a lot of bad comments on the game, on the Commodore 64. I didn't like it either when I got it. I bought it, but I returned it back in those days. But you get another perspective of how, why the game looks like it does, and you know, the story about how it came together. And I think that's really interesting.
That sounds a bit like the E.T. story for the Atari VCS. And that guy even quit the game making because it was proclaimed to be the worst computer game ever made, the worst video game ever made. And this guy actually quit so pretty, pretty sad stories. But I think we should give credit to Brian Becknell, who released the first Commodore centered book in 2005, which was Commodore on the Edge. Yeah, The Rise and Fall of Commodore on the Edge.
Oh yeah, Brian
Bagnell. And that was the first book that was ever centered on the Commodore 64. And he did the same like you. He traveled to the US, through the US, and meeting all those Commodorean guys. And this started this whole wave of, oh, let's do a retro book, you know?
Yeah. Well, he was definitely a pioneer in doing that. And I love that book. I've read it many times over and over. So that's a great book. So Brian, yeah, he definitely deserves credit for starting that trend, or being one of them. There's this guy in Germany, I can't remember, is it Vinnie Forst or something like that, who also had done a couple of books, like a joystick book and a book on a different Vinnie machines Forster. And stuff like that. Yeah. So he was also really early with doing books about retro machines.
That's true. And the books were even translated into English because it was so successful in Germany. Right. Yeah. And Brian Becknell, by the way, has also started like last year on his new book, his second book, focusing more on the Amiga and what came after the C64. So another book coming out soon. So
another book, it's already been funded. So you know, there's not going to be another Kickstarter tomorrow. But yeah,
and that's actually an interesting question. Will you do it like, for example, Chris Wilkins, and just make it as a funding base and then make the book like available freely for pushes like unlimited, or will you do it like other people and say it's just a Kickstarter project, and when it's sold out, it's sold out?
It would be stupid of me to just limit it to Kickstarter, but of course I need people's support to get it funded, or else there's not going to be a book. No, it's going to be available afterwards, definitely. If it gets funded, if it gets done at all, it's definitely going to be available, because I'm going to be spending. I've already spent like 5 or 6 months working on the book and the Kickstarter campaign, so that takes a lot of time. And if the book gets funded, I guess I'm going to be spending another year doing the book. So I want to get a as wide reach as possible.
Of course, I hope if it fails that you will try again. I mean, we spoke.
Let's hope it doesn't fail. Let's work our best.
I'll put it on Indiegogo.
you mean flexible funding?
Oh yeah, no.
I mean, we had this topic with Dave Lowe and his daughter, and they had to do it like 3 times with their Kickstarter for the CD. And so some projects just need a second or third try, unfortunately. And it always saddens me if you are so close, like 95% funded, and then they give up and then they don't try again, you know?
Yeah, well,
sometimes.
I think that, it would be a little bit devastating if the book doesn't get done, because I have some really great material that I want to put out there, and but people are voting with their money, so if they don't like the book, they're not going to buy the book. One problem that I have with this Kickstarter is the shipping costs, which I've been talking with a lot of or a few Americans, because it's important to ship books from Sweden, and I must address this, because when doing a book and sending it out like this, I need to use a courier, because I need to have some insurance if the books disappear or get smashed or whatever, and I've got to make sure that it gets to the one that has bought the book. So that's a safety for me and the people buying the book as well. I would never risk it sending by normal mail, because then it just can disappear and I don't know where it is, so that's a safety that I have to go with. And also it's really important to understand that I know in Germany you have, like, if you're sending books within Germany, it's really, really cheap, and if you're sending outside of Germany, it's still really, really cheap compared to Sweden and other countries as well. So it's important for people to know that I haven't all the money that's going for shipping, that I'm asking people to put in for shipping, is going to shipping and nothing else. Yes. That's very important to understand that.
Yeah. So you thought this really very well through.
Oh yes, you have to make a budget, and I was studying economics in high school. I sucked at it, but I got one of my best friends. He's really good at it, so he's helping me with that. So he's taking care of that stuff for me.
Actually, interestingly, I figured that some people actually were also supporting other movies, books about the topic. So you have some crossovers, like pioneers, Commodore workers, talking in this book and that movie and in the other book too, so I wonder, is there so much material and to make sure that they are just not simply repeating themselves?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
I think that in a couple of cases, of course, I mean, there's one answer to how the SID was created and why it's called SID. you know, and why it's called 6581. And you can, there's only one answer to that, really. But what I've been trying to do is, I think it also, it depends on a lot of the people that interview. So in my case, me interview them and you interviewing me right now, it depends on, you know, what depends on what you ask me. If you shoot off an interesting question my way, I'm going to be inspired by it and probably, you know, get an idea to say something I haven't said to people before, even though it might something that happened in the demo scene in 87. So that's what I've been trying to lure out of these people. Mm-hmm. And I'm also like, you know, both Charpentier and Janis is in Brian Bagnell's book from 2005. But it's not the focus on them. It's the focus on Commodore and the product. So they appear in the book here and there. But in this case, there's going to be centered stories or like focus on Al and his story, how he got started, what he, you know, why he studied and how he got his job at MOS Technology, which is a really, really funny story, by the way. And like you have Dave Collier that I've also interviewed for the book. He's a games programmer that worked for Ocean Software. And he programmed games like ER Kung Fu, Green Beret, Hypersports and stuff. A really, really technical programmer. And according to a bunch of friends of mine, really, really good looking code. So he has never talked about the old C64 days before. So I got an exclusive with him. I talked to him last year. He lives in Melbourne these days, so I couldn't go see him. So it was done through Skype. But it's, you know, that kind of stuff. And you know, try to get the my head is so full of questions that I need to get out and ask. So some of them questions are going to be about stuff they've answered before, but a lot of them is not going to be like that.
What you explained reminds me a lot of how I feel and what I see about things and how I think about things. I remember when we started doing these interviews and I had one with the sound manager of Epix, you know, Chris Grigg. People were saying, yeah. Is that fake? Did you really talk to him? You know, it took me 10 years to pin him down and another year to get to him and convince him to do the interview with me. And people were like, is this fake? Did you really talk to him? So sometimes it's incredible, you know. And he told me, like you said in that example, he also told me, like, nobody ever asked him about the C64 days. And I wonder why. Why nobody tried to talk to him? I mean, at least he was from Epix, you know. Number one sports developing game company. So
there's a lot of people out there that hasn't been interviewed yet. But you know, you gotta understand, you and me, we are super duper nerds. We wanna have all the information that other people want and then some, you know. We want to know the details. We want to know the extra stuff. And I don't think that people just remember Chris like, you know, Rob Hubbard or Martin Galway and stuff like that, because the music weren't as centered in the games as perhaps Rob Hubbard's music was. And in many cases, not as good. But with no disrespect to Chris, I love his work.
Well, there are some exceptions, of course. Everybody knows California Games intro music.
Oh, yeah.
I don't.
That's pretty famous.
You can do the other voices, guys.
Yeah, and the funniest thing is programmers made the snares and stuff like shoots, and you would shoot into into the sign at the beginning. It was not meant to be shoots. So those stories are pretty interesting. So yeah. I totally understand when you say you wanna talk to people like exclusively and get their point of view that nobody was ever interested in.
Yeah, and I must correct myself. I think the title tune for California Games was a cover of Louie Louie, if I'm not
it
wrong.
Was.
They it was. Was the it was the I think it was the first first game to license a piece of music like that. I think I did an interview with Matt Householder, who was the project manager and also the designer of California Games, together with his wife Candy. He told me that. So that was the first game that did a license, a real license, where they actually called up and asked, "Can we do a cover for this?" And they said yes, and then Epic's paid money. You see, that was not very common back in those days.
You see another puzzle piece put together. So here we go. Yeah. We should work together. We are getting this done.
yeah. No, but I mean, like you know, all this stuff has always fascinated me. There's a lot of stuff that I can't remember. I'm a typical graphic designer. I forget stuff like that. But Commodore stuff, I can people ask me. So, do you remember Commando? Yes, I do remember Commando. I remember who made the graphics and did the music for it, and which year it was released, and who like Elite in this case licensed it from and stuff like that. So
I think it was 85.
Yes, indeed. Chris Butler, both programming and graphics, and of course Rob Papa doing the music. We know all the story how we made that tune, right?
Yeah. Well, people always call me encyclopedia on legs or something, because I know all the boring stuff. So I see we are very similar here.
Oh yeah.
Right. So are there special other people that you interview or that you...
Well, I'm looking at the Kickstarter page for it now, and it's yep. laid out really nicely. And you've got...
Thank you.
Aside from the photos that you've taken, which are really, really good photos and really kind of capture the people that we're interviewing and you're talking about. You also have some C64 graphics that were contributed by Vanya Utney and some others, right?
Well, the graphics that you see there, the pixel art, it's stuff that was used in demos and stuff like that. So
right.
There's in the book, there's going to be spreads of this great art that, and I'm going to be focused on the current scene. But Vanya has agreed to pixel a new image for the book, which is something I'm really looking forward to. She's an amazing graphics artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I want to focus on what's been released, like, I don't know, maybe the last 7 or 8 years, something like that. Because I think many people that get the book maybe are not so, you know, They perhaps left the Commodore scene or stopped playing games on the Commodore like 20 or 25 years ago. So I want them to see, because the scene today is really thriving. You know, people release a lot of demos and a lot of games. And, you know, people use this and this computer to create this fantastic art. Like, I think people must see this stuff and see how it has evolved.
I agree.
Totally agree to that.
We're kind of in a renaissance as far as releases go with the 64, because we hit like a high point like late 80s, early 90s, and then it kind of slowly diminished. And now suddenly it's like every other day I come online, it's like, oh, it's a new game. You know, with packaging and everything, not even like, mm-hmm. you know, just here's a game I uploaded. It's fully, you know, manual and disc or cartridge. And
yeah.
And most games are nowadays officially working on NTSC and are often fixed for it. Mm-hmm.
Which is nice for me, because that means I can actually play them.
Yeah, at the correct speed. At the correct speed. I remember playing Test Drive, and I was thinking like, wow, this is slow. Why would somebody like to play this game? And then I got an NTSC SX64, and it was like 20% faster.
I
was like,
wow,
but still it's better than on European machines. Still it's better than on European machines.
You see a car crash coming like way ahead, and it takes like a minute before you crash, and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, it's like when something actually happens in real life, and people are like, it seemed like it took a million years. It's like that, actually in real time on the C64 emulates that in real time.
Exactly.
So you're like, oh, this really is taking a million years.
Like loading from tape back in those days. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the first part of Test Drive actually works on a super CPU in a very good speed. They actually made a frame rate limit. So if you someday get it faster, then it wouldn't get too fast. But so it's really fluent on a super CPU. Just a little geek hint.
Yeah.
For the nerds.
I gotta get myself a super CPU.
Well, try good hard. Luck. They are getting pretty expensive. One. Yeah.
I'll sell something.
Millions of your books.
Yeah, exactly. Millions. Yeah.
Kidney or something.
Yeah, probably more a kidney, yeah. Perhaps two.
And you're also offering some sweet rewards with the Kickstarter, right?
Absolutely. There are a bunch of posters. I got one of the old inlay artists or game illustrators, Dave Rowe, interviewed in the book as well. And he is also a really, really, really lovely man. And he did the cover for like the Exploding Fist and the Exploding Fist 2. And before I continue to talk about that, I bought the original painting from him for the Exploding Fist. Really? So I own that stuff now. Hmm. And I can definitely recommend people to go to his site. Just Google Dave Rowe Games Arc or something like that. Because he's selling his pieces, so if you're interested and want to buy something, go do it now. Because I think they're gonna go quick when he goes public with it. Okay. But he's a part of the book, and I'm offering posters with these designs, and also from a guy called Steinar Lund, which most people know the cover art for The Last Ninja. I know that you in the US had a really terrible cover, but in the rest of the world, we have these really, really nice, cool ninja eyes. So he did that one. And also like the cover for Megapocalypse and Armageddon Man, Mermaid Madness, and a lot of Jeff Minter titles. So that's on offer. And what else? There was a signed C64 that was on offer, but that went the first day. Oh yeah, there's is that The Last Ninja on NES?
On NES, yeah. From Carl Muller. He did
programmed it. Oh, he's
Carl Muller did the conversion on the NES.
All right.
I learned that thanks to the article that we have in the New Scene World from Andrew Fisher. Man in video games.
Yeah. That's awesome. Carl is a really cool guy, and also one of the guys that hasn't yet gotten the attention that he deserves. He's a really dedicated programmer. He was involved, I think, with Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles also, I think. Anyhow, back to the rewards. There were two C64s on offer, like signed by 22 of our old heroes, and one signed by Alex Charpentier. What else? Posters. You can become an associate producer of the book, which is really cool. You can get all these signed photos. There's been signed photos of Alex Charpentier and Mrs. Zed on offer, and now there's an offer to get these signed photos by Karen Davis Downey, Fred Gray, the fantastic great musician,
Shadowfire, Mr. Set,
and also and numerous others, Hysteria, Breakthrough. What else? What's the first one he did? I keep forgetting. Both Ali Noble and Don Jones did the graphics for that game. Pedro. Released by Imagine in 84. Yeah, he's a fantastic musician and a fantastic guy, and he's also interviewed in the book. So let's see. It would have been great to offer the book signed by everybody, But to post books all around the world to people who sign them, it's not doable. The book will be like £10,000 each. Not really, but you know.
We did that once with a disc cover for SceneWorld prize giving, and it took us half a year to get this to everybody around the globe.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's not possible. I can't do it. It would be too much money spent on signatures. So because I'm a photographer, I can print my own photos and have those sent to people to sign them. And there was a reward where you could get your own game review in the book, and that went really fast as well. I just this past Friday added so people can write their own demo review in the book as well, because they're you know, I've been a part of the demo scene since 87, and throughout the years I've been interviewing a lot of people from the demo scene and the cracking scene, of course. There's a lot of to talk about, and I want to do something special about the scene, not just put out the pixel art and put out photos from copy parties and stuff like that, but I want to do like a scene story thing, because people have been asking for it. But the problem is that I've run out of pages. So I'm really hoping that the Kickstarter is going to get a really, really big boost this week and continue to grow, so I can add the stretch goals, because I prepared some really, really cool stretch goals. Awesome. So people should check out the rewards. There's some really cool stuff that you can get the book signed. You can get like numbered books and all these kind of different perks, and if people like, if they think of something that they'd like to have that's not in the reward session, they could just send me a mail and we'll talk about it. A reward that's coming up as soon as I get an answer, an email, there's going to be, I told you about the Rob Hubbard music scripts. So I'm going to be offering like 8 different A3 posters of these scripts. So people could put these on their wall in their man cave or a girl cave or wherever you got your stuff. And like, you know, they're really cool to look at. I mean, Rob Hubbard, he's the king of Sid. There's no doubt about it. So that's going to be added to the campaign, I think, a little bit later this week. I got to be careful when I say when I'm going to add it, because people like oh, you didn't add the reward like you said you would, but you know, it depends on, like, with these Rob Hubbard scripts, I when I was writing the description text, I, you know, I realized that I haven't asked Rob if he wanted to sign them. So I kept that reward. I didn't add it to the site yet, because I want to ask him if he's willing to sign them first, because that I think is going to bring a lot of value to these prints. So that's something really to look forward to for the Rob Hubbard fans out there.
Oh, it's awesome. It's also interesting that you got people convinced doing proper interviews that like 10 years ago said no. So,
well, I don't know. Well, I know that that you, as if you want to get people on board, you got to be persistent. So for me, a no is not a no, a no is a maybe. A no is a probable yes. You just have to work on it a little bit. And it takes time. Like Mr. Said took 3 years, and it then took 8 years to finish the interview, but you know, it was a big interview, and he's one of my best friends these days, so that's an extra bonus. But to get Bob and the other guys to talk, it's you know, you gotta make them feel comfortable and tell them why you do it and make them interested in, so they understand why I wanna talk about the old days with them.
Yeah. Well, so far everybody has been happy with me.
Yeah. So no, I guess emails afterwards. No.
No. Oh. Yes. So it's good to know that you never give up. Yeah, and I mean, also we have to see. We have to be honest here. We have to do it while people are still around. You know.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I had this sad experience that I did this interview with Ralph Baer.
Yeah,
and
a few
weeks later, he wasn't there anymore. And I was the one doing the final interview and the longest.
Mm-hmm,
and I didn't think at that time that I would be that guy that did the final one.
No.
You know, so.
No, it's the same thing. I'm hitting myself on the head every time I think of the fact that I never pursued an interview with Jack Tramiel. Because that would have been possible a couple of years ago, I think, because people were not maybe, you know, they were not doing books and stuff like that. But there's this, what's this, this movie, 8-Bit Revolution or something like that.
Yes, really great. Yeah, by that Italian guy.
Yeah. Sorry to that Italian guy. I can't remember the film. I even helped promote it, but, you know. Anyway, I think it's a great movie. There's a lot of cool people in there, and Jack is in there as well. So that was
I can figure it out because I backed it. It's not a problem.
Okay. Well, I'll keep on babbling in the meantime. That's a great movie. He got Jack in there, and it would have been so great to have Jack in the book as well. Because he's even though you've heard so many stories about him and how he worked...
So it's called 8-Bit Generation, by the way, the movie.
Okay,
8-Bit Generation.
By the Italian guy.
Or something like that. Anyhow, I think it's a great movie. They have Jack in there and a bunch of other people, and Bill Hurd is doing the voiceover.
So I remember the name now. Bruno. His name was Bruno, the Italian
that they
guy.
Were, that Bruno. That, okay.
Bruno, yeah.
Okay. Grazie, Bruno. Yeah. Great movie, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, minds, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't.
Yeah. So Bill Hurd is doing the voiceover for it, you said?
No, Bill Hurd did the voiceover for that movie.
Right.
Oh.
I met him, like, last week.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Where?
Vintage Computer Festival East.
Okay, cool.
I asked him about my broken C128, and he told me to get a new one.
The Easyfix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We made thousands of them, right? He said.
Yeah. He's like, we made thousands of them. Just get another one.
Good answer, actually.
Yeah.
But of course, we would never throw this stuff away, right?
No, not at all.
We're collectors and fans.
Like, that becomes my spare, my parts machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, so... So we see you did a lot of research and so on. So let me ask you, what's the interview you are most proud of?
I haven't done all of them yet. I can't say. They're all special to me, and I want to put people in that. Partly, of course, that I think that other people would like to read about, but also people that I'm a huge fan of. Take Ben Daglish, for instance. He's one of my favorite C64 musicians. He's done so many great music, and I've been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with him. I've been to his house in England, and we've played together in Sid 80s, and he's a lovely man. You know, he's got a big heart, and he's a true, true musician. So it's been a privilege for me to you know, get to know him and hang with him throughout all these years. So there's a lot of stories like that. Same with Fred Gray. You know, I spent a lot of time with him, and, you know, I had him over on when I arranged Back in Time Live in Stockholm here in 2008. He was a special guest, and I got to play Mutants with him live on stage. Which was, it was bloody fantastic, you know. So I can't say one. Sorry, boring answer, but they're all very special to me. And you know, when you get to know these people, they're really great people, you know. So I don't want to single anyone out.
Hmm. Yeah, I've totally forgot that you also did Back in Time Live Sweden.
Yes. Yes.
You did a lot of things. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you know about the demo I did in 2006, Let's Scroll It, with HCL of Boost Design.
Oh, that I don't know.
No, it was released under C64.com, and it's retro-based. Like, you know, the design of the demo is inspired by the old demos, but it's, you know, there's new graphics from the Sarge and the Hobbit and all these other guys, and from me as well. There's one part in that demo that has 100, for some reason I like to torture myself with 100 questions and 100 scroll texts and stuff like that. But there's 100 scroll texts from 100 different people. That took me 1 year to get that together. 1 year. And I asked Rob Hubbard, and he had never written a scroll text before. So I had to give him like an idea of what kind of text he wanted, or what I wanted for the demo. So I just write whatever you want, you know. That's what scroll texts are about. You just write shit, more or less. You know, whatever's in your heart or your head. So that was a big feat as well, and that took a lot of, you know, a lot of my time, as well as the Back in Time live event in Stockholm. It took, I had a normal 9-to-5 job then, and for like 6 months, I was working on the event more or less every day, even Saturdays and Sundays. So I came home around 6, had dinner for half an hour and worked until like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and then repeated that cycle for about 6 months. So that was a lot of job, a lot of work, but it seems I like to torture myself with that kind of stuff. So, you know, every, like, I don't know, 5-10 years, that's the kind of thing I get my head sunk into, so to speak. And same thing with the book. People that know me know that I'm not going to be doing a half-assed book. It's I'm going to spend a lot of time to kind of, you know, get it right my way, to get it look good and also have a lot of nice content for people to read.
Well, to be honest about it, that retro history computer hobby, back in the day it was a lot of, why are you collecting computer trash? You cannot even make money with that. And now everything from the 80s, 90s comes back, and now you can even make a business with it, you know? Yeah. New computer hardware, new books, new movies, new games, AJ mentioned earlier. So nowadays it's a whole business. It's great how trashy, boring stuff suddenly got hip again, you know?
So, yeah, you mean boring for the other for other people? Yes.
Yes, of course. Yeah. No, for me, it's my childhood. For me, it's family memories. For me, it's amazing. But for the layman, it's fairly boring. And now suddenly everybody finds a C64 on the attic and connects it again, and you know. Or finds rare games and put them for thousands of dollars on eBay.
yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. But I think, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I love to hear stories like when I've interviewed somebody for C64.com or the book, when they tell me that they got a, you know, they got the bug back. So they went up to the attic or down to their basement and picked up their dusty C64 again and turn it on, and maybe they didn't do anything new for it, maybe not, they didn't create a new game, but they turn it on, put their old demos on and play a few of their games and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the perks of doing interviews with the old timers, so to speak. I just love to hear these stories. They're success stories in my ears, and it's just fun to hear about them. Right. But like you said, when you said that thing about laughing about, you know, this old trash, I always say there is good trash and bad trash. You know, like when I explain this to my girlfriend, there's good trash and there's bad trash. The good trash is the Commodore stuff that you bring home to you. I mean, if you would see a dumpster and there's a C64 in there, you take it home, right?
Yeah.
But if you have a can of worms, you don't take that home with you, right? And when I started working on the book, which was about a year ago, I was starting to plan the design and trying to find my angle and stuff like that. My girlfriend was laughing with love, but she was laughing about, but you're not making any money doing the book, because I'm freelancing. So if I'm not doing anything that gives me money, I can't buy diapers for my son, you know. But I had to explain to her that the even though she had a Commodore 64 when she was a kid, actually, but I had to explain to her the deep passion that I have for the Commodore 64, that it never ever leaves. When people ask me, why do you love the Commodore 64, I can't hardly explain it, because there's so many different things that I love about the machine. And that's also why I wanted to do the book. I have so much to thank the machine for, and the people that created it, and the people that make games and demos on it, because it inspired me to become the guy I am today, which, you know, is I'm a graphic designer and photographer. I don't have a university. I didn't go to university to study design. I got the Commodore 64 from my dad in 84, and I started to do graphics in 1987. So that's more or less where I schooled myself, so to speak, since 1987. And there's so many people I got to thank for inspiring me along the way.
I mean, there are a lot of old people or past people that that became active again nowadays. For example, yeah. Vito Oliver Lindau, who was once a graphician for Starby Software.
Yep.
Now he makes new adventure games graphics. Oh, yeah. You know, Karen, for example. You know?
Or
we spoke a couple of times to Dave Lowe, who was back in the day the guy who did the most conversions of music from arcade machines, and now there is a movie made about him, and he made an orchestra audio CD with his stuff, and he was actually surprised that people wanna hear that, and that people wanted this movie about him, you know, because a lot of pioneers, as we see as pioneers, they are normal guys. They thought that 20 years later, nobody would even remember their names. So, So I guess when you interview some people, they will also think in the first place, why does he want to talk to me? I'm nobody special.
Well, you're special. You're special to me.
You know, I mean, do you get sometimes this reaction to from people that you invite for an interview? Are there people that don't actually know why somebody wants to read about their career on the Commodore 64?
Not so much anymore. I used to get that perhaps a couple of years ago, and also, you know, people tend to forget what happened back in those days. Memories fade. And that's what I think what you guys are doing is so important, because you're recording an important piece of the past. And even though if you're interviewing me or Dave Lowe or Mr. Tetris himself, you're going to get your angle of the story. And I think it's very important to do that. So that's what I like, that there's a lot of stuff going on with the books and the CDs and the podcasts and all that stuff. It's all good. It's all about the Commodore 64. That's very dear to all of us. But no, I don't get that anymore. I think that I can always refer to C64.com. Most people have already been on there. And I mean, if you write a normal, nice letter to people, so they don't have to question you, if you're a weirdo or whatever, it's hardly ever is going to be a problem.
Yeah, well, there are some exceptions of people who generally never do any interview. So
Yeah, sure.
sure. Then you're on the loose end. I mean, you can only try so much. But talking about your homepage, it appears to me that interviews and articles are often from the past. Looking at it, I don't find so much new stuff, new interviews and so on. So it seems it's rather all going into that book than on z64.com.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because a lot of the material that I have on my hard disks that's going to be in the book was supposed to be on z64.com. But because I've had trouble, activating PHP programmers to get, like a gallery going and all that stuff, and a forum, and all that stuff. You know, the only chance for me to add pictures would be doing it myself in HTML, and I'm not going to do that. So there's a lot of material that could have been on Commodore 64 or C64.com. But now I'm going to put it in the book as well. But on C64.com, you know, we have, all of us that works on it, we have kids. There's a limited amount of time that we can put on the site. Especially now, my son is just over 2 years old. I can't sit all you know, evenings or nights or weekends like I used before and you know, play. Like, we add games. We don't add games like Game Base or whatever. We play the games from start to finish just to make sure that they work, and that's the copy that we put up. So it takes a lot of time. I, from time to time, get mail from people saying that, oh, you don't have this game on the site, so can you please put it up? It's my favorite game, et cetera, et cetera. So I got to put it on my to-do list, which is growing now more than ever than when I started doing the book. But eventually it's going to get on there. It's just a matter of time and you know, finding the right moment to fit it in.
So where can people find out about the book and the Kickstarter and how to contribute to it and pledge and all that?
Okay, so there's different places you can go. You can, of course, go to Kickstarter and search for C64 or Commodore 64. The name of the book is Commodore 64 for the Love of a Machine. So you can go to Kickstarter.com and search for it there. You can, there's also a link on C64.com on the front page. You can look me up on Twitter or LinkedIn. So there's a bunch of different places.
Okay, and we will, of course, link to all of these in the podcast description.
Awesome.
Well, thank you for sitting down with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for taking the time.
Guys, take care.
Cheers. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that was Andreas Wahlström. I'm looking at the page with the book, you know, the Kickstarter page for it, and it really does look like a really good, well laid out book. I mean, it's you got to check. You know, everyone should check it out for themselves. We'll put a link to the Kickstarter page in the podcast description. I'll also say it here. It's kickstarter.com/project/Wahlström/Commodore64 for the Love of a Machine. And there's dashes between all those words. Again, link is down there. And I mean, it's laid out beautifully and it's got great photos. And I mean, it's definitely worth a look and definitely worth backing, I think. And there's lots of people in there that probably haven't been interviewed many other places.
Yeah, so. That's true. As we just heard in the interview, he likes, like us, exclusive interviews with people that haven't been covered before, or Langsley interviews.
Right. So everyone should check that out. Again, links to everything that we talked about will be down there in the description. Until next time, I'm AJ, and he's Jörg, and this is what we do all the time. See ya.
Right. Bye-bye.